Durzo crept along the rafters supporting the roof of Castle Sanaria's great hall, cloaked in shadows. His work had a lot of variety. He'd always liked that, but he'd never wanted to be a maid. Yet somehow, he found himself pushing a damp rag over wood, scooping up dust meticulously, scooting forward slowly as he cleared each inch. Strangely enough, hovering 50 feet over the floor of the hall, the rafters hadn't been dusted recently, and Durzo hated being dirty. Still, no matter how careful he was, he couldn't help but dislodge little clumps of dust from time to time. Clumps that would puff out like clouds heavy with snow and drift downward, marking his otherwise invisible progress. The nobles below, mercifully, weren't exactly staring at the ceiling. The festivities were in full swing. The events of the night before had brought out everyone. Men and women celebrated midsummers and gossiped about what the king could possibly be doing. Obviously, the biggest morsel was what Logan was doing at the high table. Everyone knew he'd been arrested, and they couldn't keep their eyes off him. Why was he here? For his part, Logan was sitting like a man doomed, which was exactly what Durzo suspected he was. Knowing Elaine, the king had summoned Logan so he could publicly humiliate him in front of all the peers of the realm. Maybe he'd announce Logan's death sentence. Maybe he'd have it carried out at the table. Durzo moved again and dislodged a large clump of decades-old dust. He watched, helpless, as it spiraled down toward one of the side tables. Part of the clump broke apart in the air, but part of it hit the arm of a gesticulating noblewoman. She brushed her arm and continued her story without pause. Brushing more dust and still moving slowly, Durzo gritted his teeth. He was slipping. Of course, he always told himself he was slipping. It kept him sharp. Maybe this time, though, he really was.
Too much is happening. It's all too personal.
Durzo reached a joint where several beams came together to support the roof. There was no way to stay on top of the rafter and get past. He would have to go around or under. Whoever had designed these rafters hadn't had convenient skulking in mind. Setting climbing hooks around each of his wrists, Durzo wedged his fingers where two beams came together at an angle. It was painful, but a wet boy learned to ignore pain. He swung out over space, letting his feet release the beam. He wondered what the fat noblewoman below him would think if her dinner were suddenly crushed by a falling shadow. He held his entire weight by his fingertips and used his weight to wedge his fingers deeper into the painful crack, then released his right hand and swung to grab the other side of the joint, past the solid surface where all the beams came together. He had only his long reach to thank for making it. He got three fingertips into the crack on the far side of the beam. As he shifted his weight, the dust in the crack was just enough to slide his fingertips off. Flint rolled his wrist forward as his fingers slipped. He dropped 3 inches, and then the wrist hook caught in the crack his fingers had just left. The hook held. Flint released his left hand, and his body swung again. Now he'd fall directly on the woman instead of on her food. He pulled against the iron hook biting into his wrist and was able to reach high enough to grab with his fingers. He swung again, pulled out the hook, and grabbed the edge of the beam with his other hand. He hung there, fingertips holding his entire weight from the same side of the beam, and the grip slick with an inch of dust. Had he thought he liked his work? But with practiced grace, he swung sideways and caught the edge with a foot. Deftly, he wriggled back up onto the beam. Ignoring the dust, he pushed off the beam as he did so.
Some risks you can't help, and some you can. I haven't exactly minimized my risks, have I?
Durzo tried not to think about it, but scooting along the beam, acting like a cleaning lady, didn't take his full attention. He'd given Kyler all the hints he needed to interrupt what Roth had planned here, and he'd given him motive to make sure he came here rather than leaving town.
It's bad luck, old boy.
But what was bad luck to him now? He was going to lose no matter what. At the head table, the king stood. His face was flushed and he wobbled. He raised his glass.
My friends! My subjects! Today is Midsummer's Eve. We have much to celebrate and much to mourn. Words have abandoned me in light of what's happened in the last day. Our kingdom has endured the grievous loss of Katrina Gaia and her entire household at the hands of a murderous husband. And the loss of our beloved prince. Today, we gather to celebrate Midsummer's. Some might wonder why we celebrate in the shadow of such dark deeds. I tell you why. We wish to celebrate the lives of our loved ones and not yet mourn their deaths.
On the king's left hand, Lord General Aegon was nodding his head with grim approval. Durzo wondered how much of this speech was Aegon's. Most of it, he suspected. The king drank from his glass, forgetting that he was in the middle of a toast. The nobles throughout the room looked confused. Should they drink, or was the king not finished?
I tell you why we're here. We're here because the bastards who murdered my boy aren't going to stop me. They aren't going to get me. They aren't going to stop me from doing whatever the hell I please.
Lord General Aegon looked alarmed. Elaine the Ninth had slipped into the first person singular from the royal plural. He must have had more to drink than was apparent.
And I tell you what is our sovereign pleasure. There are schemers, plotters, traitors here tonight, yes. And I swear to you, traitors, you will die. I know you're here. I know what you're doing. But it's fucking not going to fucking work.
My king, you should...
No! Sit down, Brent. Some of you have betrayed us to Kalidor. You've murdered our prince. You killed my boy. Logan Gaia, stand.
Logan Gaia stood, shaken. He was handsome, and from what Durzo knew, formidable, and popular with both the assembled nobles and the small folk of the city.
Logan, you've been charged with my son's death, and here you are tonight celebrating. Did you kill my boy?
The king's soldiers looked scared. They looked to Captain Arturian for guidance. He nodded, and two guards stepped up beside Logan.
Let him speak!
Your Majesty, your son was my friend. I deny all charges.
I believe you, Duke Gaia.
The king turned to the nobles.
Lord Gaia has been found blameless in our sight. Logan Gaia, will you serve your country at all costs?
I will.
There was obvious tension in Logan's face. His eyes had locked on Sarah Drake's.
Then, Lord Gaia, we pronounce you Crown Prince of Cenaria. And we announce your marriage of this afternoon to our daughter, Janine. Logan Gaia, you shall be heir until such a time an heir is born to our royal house. Do you accept this duty and this honor?
I do.
Janine Gunder moved to stand beside Logan, looking as awkward as a 15-year-old can. Sarah Drake's hands flew up to her mouth. Then she fled. But nobody besides Logan noticed. The king tossed off his wine, and the nobles joined his toast, saluting Logan. Logan graciously, if somewhat woodenly, accepted the applause, nodding to his friends. Then he blushed as his new wife took his hand. Her face glowed with embarrassment at her own boldness and adoration for her husband. The nobles loved it. But as the approval roared to a crescendo, the king looked more and more vexed. And still the cheering continued. The servants were cheering. The guards were cheering. It was as if the nobles felt a black cloud lifting from their futures. Elaine Gunder was turning purple again. But no one was paying him the slightest attention.
Now go! Go consummate this marriage!
Lord General Aegon stood, but the king shoved him away roughly. Logan looked at Elaine, shocked.
Are you deaf? Go fuck my daughter!
The princess turned white. So did Logan. Then she flushed red, mortified. She looked like she wanted to sink through the floor. At the same time, barely controlled rage washed over Logan's face in a crimson wave. The honor guards on either side of him looked stunned.
Out! Get out! Go fuck! Go fuck!
Trembling, livid, Logan looked away and led his wife from the hall. The nervous guards followed.
And the rest of you! Tomorrow, we mourn my son! And I swear that I'll find out who killed my boy if I have to string up the lot of you!
The king sat abruptly. The nobles looked baffled, horrified. They slowly sat, staring at the king in silence. Durzo's mind was racing. Roth hadn't foreseen this. Couldn't have. But Durzo was sure that Roth was in the castle, maybe in this very hall. A guard with one of the minor nobles was their signalman. If he took off his helmet, the coup was off. It gave him a moment to digest what had just happened. Not the king's madness, but Logan's marriage. It was a brilliant bit of intrigue.
Now, if the king were killed, instead of four houses having equal claims while Logan Gaia rotted in the maw, Logan Gaia would clearly be the king.
With his reputation and the endorsement of the Gunders, he would get quicker obedience from the noble houses than even King Gunder had. It was a brilliant move, but it was too late. Roth had men throughout the castle. He probably couldn't afford to try again later. If the coup had been planned for tomorrow, Logan's marriage might have changed everything. As it was, Logan and Janine would just be added to the list of those who had to die. As Durzo waited, it appeared that Roth agreed. A servant approached the signal guard and spoke with him. The man nodded and kept his hands off his helmet. The coup was on.
Whatever Roth would have to fix, it would involve killing Prince Logan Gaia now, who would be conveniently tucked away in the North Tower where he'd be easy to find.
Roth would probably want to assign that job to Durzo, but Durzo had no intention of giving the Caladorum the chance. He would do what he had promised, but he wouldn't kill Kyla's friend. During the first course, the nobles had already eaten the rabbits Durzo had prepared. He'd been feeding those rabbits hemlock for a year. The amount in a portion was a small enough dose that nothing would happen to the diners unless they'd also eaten the starling appetizers. In less than a half hour, the nobles would feel ill. Hemlock poisoning started peacefully enough. Already the nobles' legs should be losing feeling. If anything, they might notice that their legs felt heavy. Soon, the feeling would spread up. Then they'd start vomiting. Anyone unlucky enough to have eaten seconds would begin convulsing.
The timing now was tricky. Poisoning wasn't an exact science, and someone might notice something amiss at any time. Durzo needed to act before that happened. He secured one end of his rope to the beam. It was black silk, ridiculously expensive, but the slenderest and least visible rope Durzo owned. Fixing the harness he'd designed specifically for this mission, Durzo wrapped the rope through it and slid off the beam. Steadying his swaying against the beam, Durzo looked down at his target. The king was directly below him. Durzo tucked in his knees and folded over. The harness bit into his shoulders, and he let out slack, slipping down toward the floor head first. Now, timing was everything. In one hand, Durzo held the rope. By adjusting its position and tension against the harness, he could dive quickly toward the floor or stop easily. When he moved, he would need to move quickly. He was shrouded in shadows so that he was barely visible, but he couldn't shroud the rope. In a room this cavernous, a rope swaying above the king as if holding weight would be noticed. The king's guards were good. Vin Arturian made sure of that. With his other hand, Durzo pulled out two tiny pellets. Both were compounds from various mushrooms. Durzo had been able to make the tiny pellets, but they didn't dissolve quickly, and for this job, he couldn't use a powder. The nobles were still silent.
What are you staring at, you damned whores and bastards? This is my daughter's wedding feast. Drink, damn you! Talk!
The king drained his wine again. The nobles pretended to be talking, and soon that pretense became a furor of speculation.
Durzo imagined that they were wondering if the king had lost his mind. He wondered the same himself. He wondered what they'd think after the king drank his next goblet of wine. A servant came and filled the king's goblet. The king's cupbearer sipped the wine first and swished it around his mouth. Then he gave it to the king, who set it down on the table.
Your Majesty, may I have a word with you?
The king turned and Durzo pushed the rope forward. He dropped like a bolt. 10 feet above the table, he pulled the rope back and jerked to a stop. 10 feet was still a long way to drop something so light, but he'd been practicing. But as he tightened the rope, it twisted, and suddenly he was spinning. Not fast, but spinning. It didn't matter. There was no time to try again. The first pellet splashed solidly in the center of the king's goblet. The second hit the edge and tinged off. The pellet rolled several inches across the table by the king's plate. Durzo coolly drew another pellet and dropped it in. The king picked up the goblet and was about to drink.
Your Majesty, perhaps you've had enough to drink.
General Agon reached a hand to take the goblet from the king. Durzo didn't waste time seeing what the king would do. He drew a short tube from his back and looked beyond Agon to the king's mage, Fergan Safasti. He saw the man, but the rope spun him away before he could shoot the blow dart. He was trying for a leg shot. His hope was that the hemlock would have deadened the mage's legs enough that he wouldn't even notice the sting. But on the next rotation, he didn't have a clear shot because the king and the Lord General were gesticulating wildly. Damn rogues. The mage's robes left barely 6 inches of his calf visible. Durzo came around again and abandoned the calf shot. The mage had shifted his feet, and Durzo only had one of the darts. Whatever they were baited with, it was a Caladoran secret that was supposed to disable the mage's magical abilities. The dart stuck into the mage's thigh. He saw a brief flash of irritation on the man's face. The mage reached down toward his thigh and was jostled by the Sakage servant.
Sorry, sir. More wine.
The man deftly snatched the dart. It was good. With hands like that, he must be one of the best cut purses in the city. But of course, Roth would only use the best.
Brain's full, you idiot. You're supposed to serve the wine, not drink it.
Durzo flipped over and scrambled up the rope. Not an easy feat with silk. He rested when he got onto the beam. He had no idea if the king had drunk the wine or not, but his part was done. The only thing to do now was wait.
Drink yourself blind, then.
General Agon didn't care if the king heard him. He didn't care if the king killed him.
Just when I thought I could deal with this bastard. He disgraces his own daughter and shames a man who's given everything he loves to serve the throne.
Agon had been able to steer the king through the marriage of Logan Geyer and Janine Gunder, but the king had hated the idea. He was jealous of Logan's looks and intelligence, jealous of how much people approved of his choice, and angry that Janine had been excited to marry Logan rather than resigned to it. But if Agon had done one valuable thing in his 10 years of serving this hell-spawned brat, it had been convincing the king to appoint Logan crown prince. Not that Logan would ever forgive him, but it was for the good of the realm. Sometimes duty required a man to do things he would do almost anything to avoid. It had been duty that had compelled Agon to serve Elaine the Ninth, and only duty. Like Agon, Logan wasn't a man who would shirk his duty. But also like Agon, that didn't mean he had to like it. Logan would probably hate Agon for it for the rest of his life, but Sanaria would get a good king. With Logan's intelligence, popularity, and integrity, the country might even become something more than a den of thieves and murderers. Agon was willing to pay the price, but it didn't sit well with him. He'd seen himself in Logan's eyes, realizing he was pledged to a destiny he would never have chosen. He'd seen the look on Sarah Drake's face. Logan would live with the guilt of that betrayal for the rest of his life. The sight had seared him. Agon had barely been able to touch his food tonight. The king tossed back the rest of his wine. The nobles were still buzzing. It wasn't the pleasant hum of conversation usual at Midsummer's Eve. The tones were hushed, the glances furtive. Everyone offered an opinion on what the king was doing, why he would appoint an heir and then insult him in the same breath. It was madness. Slowly, the king emerged from his tears and silence. He stared around the great hall with hate-filled eyes. The king pointed at one of the nobles, an unassuming count named Burrs. Everyone followed the king's finger and stared at Count Burrs. The count stiffened and reddened, but the king said nothing. His attention wandered, and he stared. For long moments, nobles continued staring at Count Burrs, then looked at the king. Then Chancellor Stigler, who was seated at the head table, stood up.
There's something in the food!
The Chancellor tottered and collapsed back into the chair, his eyes rolling up in his head. Next to him, a man the king had always hated, Lord Rule, suddenly slumped forward. His face smacked into his plate, and he lay still. Agon turned to him. The king wasn't even looking at Lord Rule, but the timing couldn't have been worse.
We're poisoned!
The king has poisoned us!
Agon turned to see who had shouted, but he couldn't tell. Had a servant said it? Surely no servant could dare.
King! The king's poisoned us!
The king jumped to his feet and stumbled drunkenly.
I hope you all die terribly, you dastardly fox!
The lords and ladies stood. Some of them wobbled and fell. An old lord started retching onto his plate. A young lady collapsed. The side door by the head table burst open, and a man in Gaia livery pushed in, holding his hands up to show he was unarmed. His livery was torn and bloody. A gash bled beside his eyes, streaming blood down his face.
Gaia livery? None of Logan's servants were here tonight.
I say treachery! Help! Soldiers are trying to murder Prince Logan! The king's soldiers are trying to murder Prince Logan! We're outnumbered! Please, help!
Agon turned to the king's guards.
There has to be some mistake. You and you, come with me!
Agon turned to the bleeding messenger.
Can you take us to...
No!
But, Slayer, we have to protect...
You will not take my men! They will stay here! You will stay here! And you, Brand, you're mine! Mine! Mine!
To Agon, it seemed he saw the king for the first time. He'd seen Elaine the Ninth as a foul, wicked child for so long that he'd forgotten what a foul, wicked child with a crown could do. Agon looked to the king's guards. Disgust was written on their faces. He could tell they ached to go defend Logan, their prince, but duty forbade them from disobeying their king. Logan, their prince. Suddenly, it became so simple. Duty and desire became one for the first time in years.
Captain Arturian! Captain! What's your duty if the king dies?
Sir, my duty would be to protect the new king, the prince.
Long live the king!
The king was staring at him, confused. His eyes widened as Aegon's sword swung back.
You fucking bastard!
Before any of the gods could attack him, Agon raised his sword over his head with both hands.
I'll answer for this, I swear! Kill me if you must, but now your duty is to the prince! Save him!
For a second, none of them moved. The rest of the panic in the hall seemed far away.
The king is dead! Long live the king! To the prince!
Together, Agon, the king's guards, and a dozen knife-wielding nobles ran from the great hall. Before Kyla got within sight of West King's Bridge, he slowed to a walk. He willed himself to be a shadow and looked at himself. He looked like a raggedly cut piece of darkness. That was good. Durzo had told him that the ragged edges obscured the humanness of his figure and made a wet boy harder to recognize. Kyla thought that his talent would also be muffling his steps. He wanted it to, but he had no idea if it was. He couldn't afford to find out the hard way. He rounded the corner and saw the guards. West Kingsbridge was controlled with a large gate like the castle's own gates. Hand-thick oak reinforced with iron, 20 feet high and spiked along the top with a smaller gate inset. The big, mailed guards looked nervous. One was fidgeting, awkwardly turning his whole head to look to the sides. The other was more calm, pointedly staring every direction except down to the river. Kyler came closer. He recognized the men despite their helmets, and not only because the twins had matching lightning bolt tattoos on their faces. They were bashers, and good ones. Lefty, he was the one with the crooked nose, and Bernard. Kyler looked where Bernard wasn't looking. In the darkness, an unwieldy barge squatted on the river like a beached sea cow. Its doors were open, but no one held any lights. But darkness no longer affected Kyler's eyes. If he'd had more time, he would have marveled about that. As night fell, if anything, his vision improved as the shadows became more uniform. Through the open doors of the barge, he saw rank upon rank of soldiers. Each wore Cenarian livery, but with a red kerchief tied around one arm. Common soldiers with kerchiefs on their left, officers with them on their right. The soldiers weren't Cenarian. Under their helmets, secreted in the shadows of the night, Kyler saw the stark, cold features of Northmen, hair as black as a raven's wing, and eyes as blue as frozen lakes. They were big, raw-boned men, weathered and hardened from exposure to the elements in battle. So they weren't just Caladorans. They were Caladoran Highlanders, the God King's fiercest, most elite troops. All of them. In daylight, that would be obvious to any Cenarian in the castle. But at night, it would take time for the Cenarian soldiers to realize that they were being attacked by a foreign enemy. The Cenarian soldiers would figure out that the armbands were what the Caladorans were using to identify each other, but it would take time. Each new group that encountered the Caladorans would have to learn it for themselves. Kyler saw another barge pulling up the river, only 100 paces away. Caladoran Highlanders tended to be broader and deeper of chest than most Caladorans, and while a few free tribes still held out in the mountains, those who had been absorbed into the Empire had become its most feared fighters. 400 or 500 Highlanders. Kyler couldn't tell, but he guessed that the other barge was full of the elite soldiers too. If so, Calador meant to take the castle tonight. The rest of the country would crumple like a body deprived of its head. Several witches were talking as they climbed the switchbacks from the water up to the bridge. They were scanning the sky over the castle, apparently looking for some sign. Indecision held Kyler frozen. He had either to get inside to save Logan. Surely Roth would have either Hugh or Durzo kill all the dukes, especially after all of Logan's fighting on the Caladoran border. Just as surely, the murder would happen shortly, if it hadn't already. Kyler could go inside and try to stop the hit, or could try to oppose the Caladorans out here.
By myself? Madness.
But just watching the barge pull closer to the bridge made him furious. He knew he should feel no loyalty to Cenaria, but he was loyal to Logan and Count Drake. If this army got into the castle, it would be a massacre. So he needed to fight inside and outside.
Great.
Kyler looked at the Sakage imposters manning the bridge. Bashers wouldn't know or care about the bridge's defenses, much less have the discipline to dismantle them. All they had done was turn the crank that lifted the massive Iron River gate. Then, in the sky above the castle, Kyler saw a long arc of blue-green flame. He started walking. The witches looked pleased. They conferred with an officer. One of the Caladorans raised a torch and waved it twice. Lefty and Bernard took torches of their own, walked to either side of the bridge, and waved twice.
All clear. Right.
Kyler drew retribution. Suddenly, the bashers turned. Lefty blinked and leaned forward. With the torches in their hands blotting out their night vision, all they saw was a thin strip of dark metal bobbing and floating through the air. Then it moved with terrible speed. In a moment, both men were dead. Kyler replaced the torch he'd plucked from Bernard's hand and checked the men on the barges. They had already formed up and were walking single file up the narrow switchbacks that led to the bridge. Grabbing the keys off Bernard's body, Kyler opened the gate and slipped through the inset door. The crank and the release for the river gate were there. The gate itself was simply a massive, counterweighted portcullis that could drop into the water. In this case, onto a ship. Kyler threw the release. Kyler looked over the side of the bridge. The river gate had slammed down onto magical stops that glowed and sparked in the darkness. He ran into the guard station. There was a fire pit with a cauldron full of stew, cooking paraphernalia, a helmet, several cloaks, chests for the men's personal belongings, and a set of knuckle bones on the low table. There was a closet full of old broad carpets stuffed in fat buckets. Kyler rushed out of the guard station. Surely the king wouldn't have left his military bridge with only that defense. The pilings of the bridge were wood sheathed in iron, impervious to fire. The sheathed wood still got wet, but couldn't breathe and release the water it absorbed, so every beam rotted within years and had to be replaced. Why would the king be so particular about fire? And then Kylo saw why. Along either side of the bridge were long wooden beams set on pivots. On the end of each beam was a huge clay globe as wide as Kylo was tall. At least part of the clay was molded over iron because a mooring rope was tied to an iron loop at the top of the globe. Several small handles also protruded from the sides. Pulling on one handle, Kylo found a bracket. As he slid it out, a wash of oil fumes swept over his face. It took him several precious seconds of staring at the entire contraption to understand. The arms would swing out over the side of the bridge, holding the globes full of oil, then drop them onto any boat passing underneath, and hopefully set it on fire in spectacular fashion. He rushed back to the gate and grabbed the torches the guards had been carrying. He closed and locked the gate quickly. The advance party of Caladorans were almost to the bridge.
What am I doing?
The first barge was just starting under the bridge. There was no time. Kylo kicked a safety latch holding the beam in place and pushed on it. It didn't move. He stumbled and almost tripped over the taut ropes at his feet.
Damn.
Kylo flung himself against the beam again. Finally, it occurred to him to use his talent. He felt power flowing through him. He could lift a wagon on his back. He pressed against the beam and could feel himself shimmering, the ragged black covering and uncovering his skin as he redirected his talent.
If I'm lucky, they won't even know I'm here until it's too late.
A ball of crackling green witchfire flew over the globe, missing it by a yard. Whether the witches saw Kylo or just his torches, they weren't pleased. Kylo pushed against the beam, but with nothing to brace his feet against, he just slid across the planks. The beam barely moved. A ball of witch fire caromed off the globe and ricocheted up into the sky. Kylo ignored it. Something white was blooming above the deck of the barge, now directly under him. A small creature took shape in front of a red-haired witch and started flying up like a hummingbird. The witch's veer marks were thick with power, directing the creature. The homunculus took shape as it zoomed toward Kylo. It was small, barely a foot tall, and pasty pale. It wore the likeness of the red-haired witch like ill-fitting clothes. It landed on the globe gently, and then rammed steely claws into the iron as if it were butter. It turned to Kylo, baring its fangs. Kylo scuttled back and almost fell off the edge of the bridge. The air in front of the red-haired witch rippled like a pond absorbing the shock of a thrown rock. Something was moving as if it were just under the surface of the air. Something huge. Reality itself seemed to be stretching and tearing. Feet from him, reality frayed and tore. Kylo had one glimpse of a gigantic lamprey-like circular mouth. It seemed to throw its mouth inside out in a spiny cone. Then the narrowest ring of teeth hit the homunculus, and the teeth snapped in the opposite direction, tearing into the pasty creature. Each successive circle of teeth pulled and snapped onto everything surrounding the homunculus with hideous strength, the cone inverting, sucking everything in. The last, widest row of teeth snapped closed on the widest part of the iron globe, and the pit worm whipped back into its hole as suddenly as it had emerged. The air rippled again and then faded as if nothing had happened. The homunculus was gone. So was three-quarters of the globe. Clay crunched and iron sheared off as if it were lard. Oil dribbled onto the water beside the barge. The first barge had passed the bridge, and the second barge was just emerging. Feeling weak, Kylo scooted back and almost fell on ropes again.
Damn it!
Then his eyes followed the ropes. They were connected to a pulley system attached to the beam.
I'm an idiot.
Grabbing a rope, Kylo pulled it hand over hand as fast as he could. The arm supporting the second globe swung out over the side of the bridge smoothly and easily.
Kill him.
Two green missiles flew past the cauldron. Next to the pulley, there was another rope. The beam holding the clay globe suddenly dropped. The globe dropped with it. For a moment, Kylo was afraid that he'd just dropped his only weapon straight into the water. But the mooring rope swung the globe like a pendulum a foot above the river. The globe slammed into the second barge at the waterline. Kylo looked at the barge from above. A nice hole gaped at the waterline, and men were running around in panic, but still he hoped for something more impressive. Men who'd been standing on the deck of the ship were thrown off their feet, and not a few of them into the water. Their armor dragged them hopelessly under the gentle waves. As quickly as it had sprung up, the gush of fire disappeared. Smoke continued to roll out of the portholes, and men were streaming up onto the deck. The barge listed heavily. Soldiers leaped from the deck to swim for the shore that looked so close and dropped like rocks. The water wasn't deep, but with the heavy armor, it was deep enough. Having paused for several moments to turn from feeding on oil to feeding on wood, the fire advanced again like an insatiable beast. Fire roared up out of every deck on the ship, and even as the barge drifted forward, Kylo saw that it wasn't going to make it to shore. A few men had the sense to tear off their armor before they leaped overboard, and others were clinging to bridge pilings, but at least 200 Highlanders would never fight on Sonarian soil. The gate behind Kylo shook as something struck it.
What now?
The gate blew apart, and the witches aglow with power strode through its smoking remains. Kylo ran for the castle. With Neff Dada and a dozen soldiers in Sonarian livery trailing behind him, Roth sprinted across the catwalk. He reached a small room, turned right, and pounded up a narrow set of stairs. It was a dizzying maze of corridors, walkways, and service stairs, but it would get Roth and his men to the North Tower twice as fast as any other route. Time was of the essence. So many plants that Roth had planted, watered, and coaxed into bloom over the past years were bearing fruit tonight. Like a greedy child, he wanted to taste every one and let the bloody juices spill down his chin. The Queen and her two younger daughters were dying right now, Roth realized with regret. It was too bad. Too bad he wouldn't get to see it. He hoped nobody would move the bodies before he could come inspect them. He'd given orders, but though he trusted Hugh Gibbet to carry them out meticulously, this was war. There was no telling what would happen. There was no help for it, though. There was no way he would have missed watching the King die. How exquisite that was. If Roth hadn't been dodging around corners, he'd have burst out laughing. He'd planned to have a bolt cranked in his crossbow and pointed at the King's forehead all night. He'd planned to be the one to kill the King himself, but Captain Arcturian's security had been too tight. Roth had been able to get into the Great Hall, but he hadn't been able to bring a weapon. It had been a small disaster. If Durzo Blint hadn't come through for him, the entire plot would have failed. Father would have killed him. But it didn't fail. Durzo had come through for him, and what a virtuoso performance it had been. The poisoning of the guests had been brilliant. Roth had been in the kitchens as the food tasters had tried every dish, and not a one had even been ill. The delivery of the King's poison had been a marvel of athleticism. The concoction itself had worked even better than Blint had promised. Roth would find more work for that man. With Durzo as his tool, Roth would dispense such exquisite agonies as he'd never before imagined. Herbs. He'd never even thought of their potential. Durzo would be just the one to guide him in all their uses. Who would have imagined that herbs given to the King would push Agon over the edge? He had positively giggled when the Lord General had relieved the Fool King of his head. It had been better than doing it himself. He'd never had the particular thrill of watching a man commit what he himself must have seen as treason. There was something very fine about seeing a man damn himself. Roth and his men had tarried in the Great Hall just long enough to see that the Lord General and his men had taken the bait and were on their way, and then they had run. If he had planned this right, and Roth planned everything right, He'd taste even finer fruits than Aegon's betrayal tonight. Father would be so pleased. 600 of the God King's elite Highlanders were to arrive at the castle within the next half hour. 1,000 more would arrive at dawn. The king had told Roth that he wanted to lose less than half of those by the time he arrived with an occupying army the next day. Roth thought he would lose less than a quarter, perhaps far less. He'd pass his Uruddon brilliantly. The God King would appoint Roth King of Sonaria and take the title of High King for himself. In time, he'd pass the entire empire to Roth. Pushing future glories from his mind, Roth came to a stop in the last narrow corridor as his men caught up. The door before him would open on unseen hinges into the stairway at the bottom of the North Tower. Roth motioned to his men. They slammed the hidden door open and burst into the hall, swords flashing. The two honor guards posted at the base of the tower and stand a chance.
We hold this door. Aegon doesn't go upstairs. The prince and princess are next.
Logan sat on the edge of the bed, waiting. He closed his eyes and rubbed his temples. He was, for the moment, alone in the bedchamber at the top of the North Tower. Janine Geyer, had left him to get ready. To get ready. Logan felt ill. He'd fantasized about lovemaking, of course, but he'd done his best to confine his desires to one woman. And that woman wasn't Janine. When Sarah had accepted his proposal, he thought his fantasies were going to come true. They'd been planning their wedding just this morning. Now this. Janine's hair was down, curling luxuriantly halfway down her back. She wore a silky, translucent white gown and an anxious smile. She was breathtaking. Every hint her evening gown had given last night, God, was that only last night? Was fulfilled. Every sensuous promise succeeded. Logan's eyes drank in her curves, her hips sweeping to a narrow waist, waist swelling to those perfect breasts, curve yielding to curve with the sweetness that inspired art. He feasted on the gold of her skin in the candlelight, the darker circles of her nipples showing faintly through her gown, the flutter of her pulse at her throat, the bashfulness in her stance. He wanted her. He wanted to take her. Lust roared through him, dimming the rest of the room, swallowing all the world except the beauty before him and his thoughts of what he was about to do. He looked away, ashamed. A lump swelled in his throat and cut off his breath.
Am I so ugly?
No. No, my lady. Please come here.
She didn't move. It wasn't enough.
Please. Please, you're so pretty. So beautiful. You bewilder me. You make me ache. Come, sit with me, please.
Janine sat next to him on the bed, close, but not touching him. Logan had known little about her before today. Even his father had considered her too rich a match for him. He only knew that she was well-liked, sunny, settling down, and not yet 16. Logan could understand Sunny. She'd practically glowed at dinner until her father had spoken. The bastard. Logan understood now a little of how his father must have felt seeing the woman he loved married to that. The term settling down had been applied to Janine's brother, too. For the prince, it had meant that people thought he was finally leaving off his more obvious wenching and starting to assume some of the responsibilities of ruling. But Logan imagined that for Janine, settling down probably meant she didn't play tag in the castle anymore. She was so different from Sarah. And she was his wife.
I was engaged to another woman this morning. A woman I loved for years. I still love her, Janine. Can I call you that?
You may call me whatever pleases you, my lord husband.
He'd hurt her. She was hurt, and for all the wrong reasons. Damn, she was young. But then, he hadn't been the only one who'd been handed a lot of surprises in the last day.
Have you ever been in love, Janine?
I've liked boys.
It's not the same.
Are you going to cheat on me with her?
It hit Logan between the eyes. This couldn't be easy for Janine, either. How must she feel, liking him, marrying him, knowing he was in love with someone else?
I swore our wedding vows because the king asked me to, because the nation needed it. But I swore those vows, Janine. I will be faithful to you. I will do my duty.
And your duty to produce an heir?
Yes.
She flopped on the bed, pulling her gown up roughly and spread her legs.
Your duty awaits, my lord.
Janine, look at me.
Logan covered her nakedness and, thank the gods, looked only at her face as he spoke. Though even now, her body cried out to him. It made him feel like an animal.
Janine, I will be as good a husband as I can. But I can't give you my heart. Not yet. I look at you and I feel wrong for wanting to make love to you. But you're my wife! Damn it, it would be easier if you weren't so damned beautiful. If I could just look at you without wanting to do what we're supposed to do tonight. Do you understand?
She obviously didn't. But she sat back up and folded her legs under her. Abruptly, she was a girl again, blushing for what she'd just done, but her eyes intent.
I don't blame you. I don't understand it myself. It's all so twisted up. Nothing makes sense since Elaine...
Please don't talk about my brother tonight, please.
I've lost everything. Everything's wrong. How can I be so selfish?
He'd lost a friend, but she'd lost her big brother. She must be aching, too.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I've known for my whole life that I'd be married to whomever the country needs me to marry. I've tried not to even have crushes because I knew that my father might tell me any day that he needed me. I've been trying not to like you for 2 years. I know you think I'm a silly girl, but do you know who some of my potential husbands were? A current prince who liked boys. Another who's 60, an Alataran who's 6, a Lodrakari who doesn't speak our language and already has 2 wives, Caladorans who treat their women as cattle, and a Modaini who's been 2x widowed under suspicious circumstances. Then there was you. Everyone likes you. A good king would have made the match to heal the split between our families, but my father hates you. So I had to watch you. Hear stories about you from my brother and from all the other girls. Hear that you're brave, you're honorable, you're loyal, you're smart. My brother told me that you were the only man he knew who wouldn't be intimidated by my mind. Do you know what it's like to have to use small words and pretend not to understand things so you don't get a bad reputation?
Logan wasn't sure he understood. Surely women never had to pretend not to be stupid, did they?
When I found out I was marrying you, it felt like all my little girl dreams were coming true. I'm sorry, my lord husband. You've been honest with me. I know you didn't ask for this. I'm sorry you had to lose her so I could have you. I know you had a lot of bad surprises recently, but I'm going to do all I can to be a good surprise, my lord. I'm going to strive to be worthy of your love.
By the gods, what a woman! Logan had looked at Janine last night and seen breasts. He had seen her giggling with her friends and seen a child. He was a fool. Janine Gunder, Janine Geyer, was a princess born to be a queen. Her poise, her deliberate self-sacrifice, her strength awed him. He had hoped his wife might grow to become a good match for him. Now, he hoped that he might grow to become a match for this woman.
And I'll do all I can to make our love grow, Janine. I just...
Janine put a finger on his lips.
Will you call me Jenny?
Jenny. Jenny. May I kiss you?
Jenny abruptly became an uncertain girl again, until their lips met. Then, even with all her hesitations, uncertainty, and naivete, to Logan, she was all that was warm and soft and beautiful and loving in the world. She was all that was woman, and she was altogether lovely. His arms circled her, and he pulled her close. Some minutes later, Logan pulled away from her on the bed, turning his head toward the door.
Don't stop!
Boots.
Lots of boots. Not even pausing to pull on his clothes in the darkness, Logan rolled off Janine and caught up his sword. Regnus Geyer ducked back into a hallway as Brant Agon ran past with a dozen royal guards and, inexplicably, a few fat nobles.
Long live the king! To the prince!
To the prince?
The rumors must have been wrong then. Regnus had heard that Elaine Gunder had been murdered last night. Had the Lord General been alone, Regnus would have called out to his old friend, but not with Vin Arturian there. Vin was duty-bound to arrest Regnus, and he would, even if he didn't like it. Having so much happening that he didn't understand made him anxious, but he could do nothing about whatever was happening elsewhere in the castle. He only had 6 men, none of them in armor. It had been hard enough to smuggle themselves in as servants and still bring swords. All he could hope to do was find Nalia and get her out of here. The Queen's chambers were on the 2nd floor of the castle in the northeast quarter. Regnus and his men had been walking through the castle nonchalantly, in 2 groups of 3, trying not to attract the servants' attention, but now he gestured sharply. His men gathered around him, and he started jogging. They got to the Queen's chamber without running into a single servant or guard. It was unbelievably good luck. Against even a pair of royal guards who would be armed and armored, Regnus and his unarmed men might all have died. A lady-in-waiting who'd been about to open the door fell back in surprise.
You! Me lady from murderer!
Nalia Gunder was seated in a rocking chair, embroidery obviously untouched in her lap. She stood immediately, but waved the servant off.
Don't be a fool! Be gone!
Nalia's 2 younger daughters, Elena and Elise, both looked like they had been crying. They stood uncertainly, neither old enough to recognize Duke Geyer.
What are you doing here? How did you get here?
Your life's in danger. The man who attacked my estate last night has been hired to kill you tonight. Please, please, my queen.
My lord.
It was how a queen might greet a favored vassal. It was also how a lady might address her husband. In those 2 words, Regnus heard her say,
I've never loved anyone but you. My lord Regnus, I'll go wherever you lead, but we can't go without them. If I'm in danger, they are too.
Your girls can come along?
I mean Logan and Janine. They wed this afternoon.
The brief cries suddenly made sense. They'd abbreviated it. The king is dead. Long live the king. They meant long live the new king, the prince, Logan. King Gunder was dead. Logan was the new king. A better man would have had other thoughts first, Regnus knew. A better husband would have had other thoughts first. But his first thought was that Nalia's husband was dead. The hateful little man who'd caused so much misery was gone. His own wife was gone, too. He and Nalia were both, suddenly, miraculously, freed from 22 years of bondage. 22 years, and what he'd thought was a life sentence had suddenly been commuted. He consigned himself to the satisfactions of a proud father and an able commander, never believing that he'd have anything but marital agony to come home to. Now, happiness wasn't just a dim possibility. It was here. One step away, beaming at him, eyes full of love. What a difference it would be to come home to Nalia, to share her home, her conversation, her life, her bed. If she would have him, he would marry Nalia. He would marry her. The other implications came to him more slowly. Logan was the new king? The genealogists would have nightmares if Regnus and Nalia had children. He didn't care. But then he stopped to think. Aegon, the guards, and the nobles had been running to his son, armed with dinner knives.
Logan is in danger.
Those men had been running to save him. Logan was in danger, and Regnus had turned aside. There wasn't time to explain everything, to tell Nalia that she was free, that Elaine was dead. Regnus had to act. He had no idea how much time they had left.
We're in trouble! Follow me!
Something hot lanced through his back and then was gone. Ragnus turned and rubbed his chest, irritated. He saw something black flit into the shadows as blood suddenly bloomed from one of his men's throats. As if they were marionettes whose strings had been cut, his men fell one after another in rapid succession. Ragnus's hand came away from his chest sticky. He looked down. Blood was spreading on the front of his tunic over his heart. He looked up at Nalia. The shadow was behind her, holding her. One black hand held her chin up. The other held the long, thin, short sword that had killed Ragnus. But Nalia's eyes were fixed on him, and wide with horror.
Nalia!
His vision was going white. He tried to keep his eyes open, but then he realized his eyes were open, and it didn't matter anymore. Lord General Agon and his ragtag band of nobles and royal guards were not making good time. Through the centuries, the castle had undergone several expansions and no simplifications. Twice, the general's men had been stopped by a locked door, argued the relative merits of hacking it down or going around, and decided to go another way. Now they ran down the last hallway to the north tower. One of the royal guards, Colonel Gare, was standing at the entrance to the antechamber.
Hurry, my lords!
Scanning the room, Lord Agon let the younger, more athletic men attack the thick door to the stairs. The room wasn't large, barely 20 feet square, sparsely furnished, with ceilings so high they were lost in the darkness, and just two doors, one to the stairs and one to the hall. There was no going around this door. Something wasn't right. That the door was locked meant that the guards posted here had either been killed or subverted. Lord General Agon looked over his shoulder to where Colonel Gare was ushering the last nobles into the room.
Everyone out! It's a trap!
Agon could only watch from the floor as Colonel Gare slammed the doors and threw the bolt. For a moment, everyone in the room stopped. As the Lord General stood with the assistance of one of the royal guards, he could see the implications hitting the men. If they'd just been betrayed by one of their own, then the attempt on the prince's life wasn't isolated or poorly planned. Everything in the last few days had been orchestrated, from Prince Elaine's death to their own arrival at this dead end. Their odds of surviving weren't good.
What do we do, sir? Get through that door!
Lord Agon pointed to the door guarding the stairs. It was probably too late. They would probably find enemy soldiers and dead royals up those stairs, but Agon had long ago learned not to waste time on the battlefield lamenting what you should have done, what you should have seen. Recriminations could come later, if there was a later. The royal guard went down, his mailed chest pierced as easily as if he'd been wearing silk.
Damn! Murder holes!
The men looked around wildly, trying to guard against an enemy that attacked from nowhere. Agon and the men looked up into the darkness. A low-hanging chandelier destroyed their chances of seeing beyond it. Guards and nobles alike scrambled for whatever cover they could find, but there was precious little to be had. One soldier rolled behind a thickly stuffed wing-backed chair. A noble tore a portrait of Sir Robin from a wall and held it before himself like a shield.
The door!
There was no way out. The men or men shooting them not only had numbers and traitors in the castle, they also knew the castle's secrets.
The door!
A rent appeared in the door.
General Agon, we are making progress!
The man spun around once before a bolt from above clove his spine. Both of the last two guards snapped. One dropped his sword and fell to his knees. The last was Captain Arturian. He attacked the door like a man possessed. He was a strong man. The door shuddered and rocked under his blows. His cheek had been grazed, cut in a neat line, his ear sliced in half. Captain Arturian threw his sword through the hole like a spear. He grabbed the latch and tore it out of the door, jerking as an arrow went into his arm. Ignoring it, he seized the door and heaved, tearing it from the frame. Five Caladoran archers wearing Cenarian livery stood on the stairs with arrows drawn. Six swordsmen and a witch stood behind them. Another archer lay at their feet, the guard's sword sprouting from his stomach. In that no time, before reality came crushing back into place, Lord Aegon looked at the nobles. They looked at him. These were the men who'd been willing to put their own lives at stake to rescue the prince. Brave men, if some of them fools, he thought as he looked at Lord Ungert, shielding himself with a painting. These were the men he'd led to death. By killing these men, the Calador would eliminate the very men most likely to oppose them. Brilliant.
So you know whom to curse as you die. I'm Prince Roth Ursul.
Ursul!
Lord General Aegon remained standing. Death would find him on his feet.
I want to thank you, Lord General. You have served me well. First you killed the king for me. A nice bit of treason, that. And then despite that, you were able to lead these men to my trap.
You will be rewarded well.
What?
Old Lord Brayton looked at Brant with alarm.
Say, it's not true, Brant!
It's a lie.
But Lord Brayton was already dead.
I wasn't lying, Lord General. You'll have your reward.
I'm not afraid.
The bolt hit Aegon's knee and he felt bone shatter. Another bolt tore through his elbow. It felt like it had torn his arm off.
My wet boy told me I could trust you to run blindly into this trap. After all, you were stupid enough to trust him.
Brilliant!
Yes. But he didn't tell me you'd betray your king. That was delicious. And marrying Lord Geyer into the royal family? Friend of yours, isn't he? You cost Logan his life with that. I know you're not afraid to die, Lord General. The reward I give you is your life. Go. Live with your shame. Go on now. Crawl away, little bug.
I'll spend the rest of my sorry life hunting you down.
No, you won't. You're a whipped dog, Brant. You could have stopped me. Instead, you helped me every step of the way. My men and I are going upstairs now. The prince and princess will die because you didn't stop me. So why would I kill you? I couldn't have done this without you.
Roth left the Lord General there, gasping on the floor, shattered. Sergeant Bamram Gamble drew the Alateran longbow with the broad muscles of his back. It didn't matter if you were as strong as an ox. You couldn't draw an Alateran longbow with your arms. He stood on the roof of the guardhouse in the castle yard. It had been barricaded in by a traitor, but the coward had either not had the stomach or not had the torch to set fire to the guardhouse with them inside it. Gamble's men had knocked a hole in the roof and lifted him out. The witch's first bolt had flown high past the sergeant's head before he'd even strung his bow. The witch was the only Meister in the yard, stationed to keep an eye on things, evidently. From Gamble's perch, he could see that more troops were streaming over the East King's Bridge, even now. But he had eyes only for the witch. It was a woman, her hair red, skin pale. She was breathing heavily, as if the last bolt had taken something out of her. But she was already pulling herself together, the black veer on her arm straining. There was no aiming. It was purely instinctive. A ball of fire ignited between the witch's palms. The power that would have carried the arrow through armor had no trouble piercing ethereal flame or a young woman's sternum. Gamble slid down the roof and dropped into the yard as two burning arrows sank into the thatch. The fire spread unnaturally fast. By the time he unbarred the door, there was already smoke pouring out of the inside of the barracks.
What do we do, sir?
They can't take us all at once, so they're trying to separate us. I guess there's 200, maybe 300 of them. We've got to get to the lower barracks.
There would be 200 men there. That would be even odds, at least. Not that Sergeant Gamble thought even numbers would even anything. but against Caladoran Highlanders and witches.
Oh, to hell with that! I'm not dying for Nina! We've still got East Kingsbridge! I'm out of here!
You head for that bridge, Jules, and it's the last thing you'll do. This is what they pay us for. Anything less than our duty is betrayal, just like Konya locking us in the barracks to die.
They don't pay us shite!
We knew what they paid when we signed up.
You do what you gotta do, sir!
Jules sheathed his sword and turned confidently. He started jogging for the bridge. Every man of his 39 was looking at Sergeant Campbell.
We're going to fight. Any questions?